Case number 10-1371 et al. Natural Resources Defense Council Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency and Gina McCarthy in her official capacity as Administrator, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Pugh and Mr. Johnson for Petitioner NRDC, Mr. Oakes for Respondent, and Mr. Phillips for the Intervenor.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Pugh, and with my colleague Seth Johnson, I represent the petitioners. I'm going to address EPA's decision to weaken and delay compliance with its long overdue standards for cement plants. Mr. Johnson is going to address EPA's creation of an affirmative defense that prevents federal courts from applying penalties to cement companies that break the law. The standards that EPA weakened and delayed in this rule were due in 1997. EPA issued them finally in 2010, and in the Portland Cement Association case, this court declined to either vacate or stay them, leaving the three-year compliance clock running. The protection that Congress intended people to have more than 13 years ago was finally going to start. Compliance was finally going to start in September of this year, in 2013. But 7 months before the compliance date arrived, EPA chose to gratuitously weaken the particulate matter standard, and then it used that weakening as an excuse for delaying all of the standards for another 2 years.
So they have two arguments in response, as you know, to that, and one is that it's not weaker, that it's a different mode of monitoring, and that's equivalent. So why don't you address that, if you could.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there are a number of reasons that it's easy to see that that's wrong. The first one is that the results are different. EPA says that the standard that it issued, the 0.07 particulate matter standard, allows plants to do less to control their emissions. For example, at page 140 of the Joint Appendix, it says that they can cancel upgrades or not replace equipment that they were otherwise going to replace. EPA didn't say that of the standard that it would have issued if all it had done here was respond to the Portland Cement Association decision.
So can I just clarify that then what you're saying then is not that there's a weakening because they took out of the mix the commercial kilns and therefore went from 0.4 to 0.5 or 0.04 to 0.05. I may have the decimal in the wrong place. But the weakening occurred subsequently when it went from 0.05 to 0.07.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, the record is plain.
The 0.05 to the 0.07 is related, they say, to the change in the kind of monitoring. And so...
That's right. What EPA says is not that it moved it from 0.05 to 0.07 in response to the Portland Cement Association, but it is so because it voluntarily just chose to drop the continuous monitoring requirement. So, I mean, I think that's just a point to be clear on because EPA states in its brief several times that this is a response to the Portland Cement Association case, and it's
right.
Not.
Right. That is separate. So how about if it were reversed, if it went from stat to continuous monitoring, would that be, I thought we had indicated that that would not be a more stringent standard, or that you had argued that would not be a more stringent standard.
No, Your Honor. This issue simply didn't come up in the Portland Cement Association case. The court didn't bless it. We didn't argue it.
Right.
It simply went unreviewed. And so the question is this standard weaker? Is this 0.07 standard weaker than the 0.05 standard? And the answer is yes. That's why this 0.07 standard will allow plants to do less to control their emissions. And in case there was any doubt about that, what EPA said about the 0.05 standard, both in the record and its filings before this court, is that it would leave cement plants' compliance strategies, quote, unaltered. And I think one of the most revealing parts of EPA's brief is where the lawyers say that that is an incorrect claim. They don't have any cites for that assertion, but essentially they're recognizing that that claim undermines their argument. They want to get away from it, but there's simply no basis in the record to say that EPA ever reevaluated or revised that assertion anywhere. If I can move on, I mean, I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, to the so their other argument on this, as you know, is the statutory argument about the word other.
So right. So the other argument would be that the statute allows them to weaken Section 112 standards.
Yeah.
And the plain meaning of Section 112(d)(7) refutes that argument. D7 says that EPA may not apply a Section 112 standard to replace or diminish a more stringent standard issued under Section 111, Part C or D of the Act, or, quote, other authority of the clean of this chapter. And this chapter just means the Clean Air Act. Because Section 112 is an authority of this chapter, applying Section 112 standards to weaken more stringent Section 112 standards violates the plain and literal meaning of the Clean Air Act. And this court's holding on
you, of course, you have to prevail not only in, I think, well, tell me if you agree with this, that not only in saying that that's the better reading, but that it's the only possible reading. So
that's
do
right.
You at least acquiesce in that notion that you have to meet that standard?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we agree that is the, we have to show that that's the plain meaning, but I think that the beginning point is that's the literal meaning. And this court's holding in the engine manufacturers case, in the New York case, in the New Jersey case, all say that where EPA wants to advance an interpretation that's at odds with the literal meaning of the statute, it's EPA's job to show that Congress actually didn't mean what the statute says.
And you got the title to deal with, which suggests other requirements preserved, which cuts against you a little bit.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest it really doesn't. It doesn't say requirements under other statutory provisions preserved. It says other requirements preserved. And a previously issued Section 112 standard is another requirement. But even if there were some doubt about that, statutory titles can't trump plain statutory language.
What about the idea that your reading would mean that they could never do an amendment or a change for any reason, even something where it was technically required?
That's simply not accurate. Congress provided mechanisms for them to change standards if they don't think they're accurate. There's the reconsideration process under Section 307D. There's judicial review. These are the mechanisms that Congress chose.
Are there time limits on those?
There are time limits on
those. So if you have a situation in which the time period has elapsed, and I don't know off the top of my head what those time limits are, but if you have a situation where the time limit has elapsed, but then experience shows to the EPA that the method of compliance that was presumed by the prior approach just turns out to be unworkable for reasons completely unanticipated to everybody in the industry.
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. And the first is the idea that kind of gross flaw would go through the rulemaking process unnoticed seems really unlikely, especially in this kind of rulemaking where EPA is intimately involved in the rulemaking process from the very beginning, as the record in this case shows. But the other point is that there is another provision in the Act. 307B provides that for grounds that arise after the 60th day, people can file a petition for judicial review within 60 days of the time that the grounds arise.
Mm-hmm.
If I can move on to the delay issue, because I think that if the court agrees that the weakening is unlawful, everything has to be vacated. But even if the court didn't agree that the weakening was unlawful, the delay is unlawful independently. And the first aspect I'd like to address about the delay is EPA's decision to delay the standards that it did not change. Those are the standards.
Right. I have a lot of questions for them on that. They say it's interrelated, so tell me why it's not.
I'm not sure that I would disagree that the compliance strategies that some plants will use to comply with these different standards are interrelated. I mean, it's possible that some plants may have interrelated compliance strategies. Our point is that it doesn't matter because the statute is very plain on this issue. Mm-hmm. The statute says that after the effective date of any emission standard, EPA must establish a compliance date for existing sources that is no later than 3 years after the date of such standard. there's no dispute that these standards, the mercury standard and the hydrogen chloride standard and the total hydrocarbon standard, are all emission standards under Section 112. And there's no dispute that these standards have been in effect since 2010. They were issued in 2010. This court refused to vacate or stay them, and EPA expressly retained them. That's the word EPA used in the final rule. So the compliance clock has been running continuously on this.
Do you think it makes sense to have a different compliance date for the different pollutants?
I don't think that EPA should have weakened the PM standard, and if it hadn't done that,
just on my question, does it? I understand your statutory argument may be that this question is irrelevant, and I understand that. But do you think, as a general matter, it makes sense to have different compliance dates?
As a general matter, it may not be ideal, but I think Congress contemplated it because Section 112(i)(3)A refers to the date or dates that EPA would set for a category. So clearly Congress envisioned the possibility that Congress would set different dates for different standards.
But in this particular industry, this particular situation we have before us, it doesn't seem that it makes a lot of sense to have a different compliance date, given that the strategies to ensure compliance would really take account of all the pollutants.
I think that may not be the policy outcome that EPA would have reached if it had done things right. But I would also point out, these are first-time standards that are now 13 years overdue. There's no plant is complying with any standards for mercury or hydrogen chloride or total hydrocarbons right now, even though these standards were due in 1997, and even though this court ordered EPA to set those standards all the way back in 2000 in the National Plant Association case.
On mercury, for example, so regardless of whether EPA used the language of retained, and perhaps what they meant by retained was that ultimately they arrive at the same amount, even if the methodology for arriving at that amount has changed materially. With mercury, the same amount results, but it was by virtue of a pretty different process, right? Because they did the analysis that they needed to do in light of this court's remand, and then they achieved a particular result. But then they decided to go beyond the floor and get back to the old number. And is it your view that even though there was a materially different way of arriving at the same number, the fact that they happened to come out at the same number means that the standard?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's especially true given that this court expressly declined to vacate or stay that standard. The clock has been running throughout the process. So the only way that this could be viewed to restart the clock is that somehow repromulgating an identical standard restarts the compliance clock. And I just don't think that's what Congress meant with this three-year standard. I mean, this is a standard that's part of an act that was supposed to solve.
How about repromulgating the identical standard when it's interrelated with other standards that are changed and promulgated anew?
I think that's a policy argument, but I don't think it goes to the statutory requirement. But I realize I'm running a little bit late, but if I could also address the other another prong of this 112(i)(3)A analysis, which is that standards have to be the EPA has to require compliance with standards as expeditiously as practicable. And EPA's decision to weaken one standard didn't make it any less practicable for plants to comply by 2013. There's nothing about weakening the PM standard that stopped plants from meeting the same compliance date that they were going to meet all along.
Practicable, as you know, that's classic language of discretion for an agency to operate within, admittedly within some bounds, but gives them a fair amount of discretion.
Well, I think it's very strong language, mm-hmm. but in addition to that, there is no finding in the record. EPA has never said it's not practicable for compliance for plants to comply by 2013. What it said is something very different. It said if plants want to use completely different compliance strategies to do less so that they can do less to meet this weakened PM standard, they'll need more time to do that. It's never claimed that it's not practicable to meet the 2013 deadline.
So what if you have a situation in which there's a method that could be done pretty quickly, but it's less effective? And it would take more time to do something that's actually more effective. And so what EPA says is, yeah, it's practicable to do it really soon, but that actually, and achieve the standard, but that actually would turn out to be less effective because if you took more time, you'd surpass the standard. And so what we're going to do is give additional time to see if the industry can implement the more effective solution. Under your reading of the statute, it seems to me that you'd say, no, EPA has to do the less effective, although quicker one. Or am I missing something?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think if EPA made a real determination in the record that either for technical reasons or for other reasons it wasn't practicable to comply by 2013. This would be a different case. But that's not this case. Here, all we have is a determination by EPA that if plants want to do less to control their emissions, they need more time to do that. And that doesn't go to practicability. That's a different question. That goes to what's convenient or cheap, but it's certainly not about what's practicable. And what's more, I don't think EPA's interpretation could be limited in any way. If EPA is allowed to put off compliance this way by just gratuitously changing, you know, a standard shortly before the compliance date, what would stop it from doing again and again and again? And we would never have compliance.
This change is consistent with the settlement, right?
This change was what EPA promised to do in its settlement with Portland Cement Association.
I think the answer to what you had just said is there's still arbitrary and capricious review. Agency action has to be reasonable. So if they keep doing this for obvious delay reasons, the arbitrary and capricious standard would kick in. That doesn't help you in your statutory argument, but there is a backstop of arbitrary and capricious review.
But I guess I think that may be true, Your Honor, but it would be played out against what's practical. And I think that EPA would have to make a record that it really wasn't practicable for plants to comply, and that's simply not the case here.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Seth Johnson, also for petitioners. EPA's affirmative defense is unlawful for at least four reasons. First, EPA is overriding the plain text of the Act, which directs district courts, not EPA, to apply any appropriate civil penalties in citizen suits against a plant that violates its emission standards. Second, EPA has no authority to arrogate to itself power that Congress expressly granted the judiciary. Third, EPA is entirely wrong to claim that the absence of an express prohibition on affirmative defenses for malfunctions means EPA can invent one. Finally, EPA can't privilege its policy ahead of Congress's policy, which was that citizen enforceable standards apply at all times, with civil penalties a necessary remedy for a court to be able to apply in citizen suits. The Act is clear that EPA lacks power to tell district courts that.
Before you go to that, there's a threshold question about standing. Mm-hmm. And can you just, you've had a variety of arguments in your briefs about standing. Can you just say what the principal argument you're relying on is,
sure,
in terms of your standing?
The affirmative defense hurts us because it changes the rules of the game by which we try to protect ourselves against harmful emissions from cement plants, and it makes it more difficult for us to protect ourselves. This is supported by D.C. Circuit case law, the Shays case from 2005, and it's also supported by Supreme Court case law, the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority case from, I think, 1991. In the Shays case, the court explained that
Well, I guess one way to ask the question, maybe to put a finer point on it, is part of your opponent's argument as to your lack of standing has to do with whether you would have standing in the second case, the citizen suit. Right? And
Yeah. And
under Steel Company, the argument goes you would not have standing because you can't establish under the Steel Company rubric that you would have an adequate stake in still civil money penalties. And what is your response to that aspect of their standing position?
Well, one, I don't think Steel Company is relevant because in that case, all of the violations had abated, and we've presented evidence, unrefuted evidence, with our standing declarations that violations that plants attribute to malfunctions are repeated. For example, Jennifer Swearingen, who lives in Montana, close to the Wholesome Trident cement plant and is a board member of Montanans Against Toxic Burning. She's been tracking the company's upset reports for the last 12 years or so, and they constantly, every year, have malfunctions that lead to exceedances, and they write them off to unavoidable malfunctions that weren't caused by bad operations, bad design, and there was nothing they could have done.
I guess thinking about your standing argument, I had a way that I thought was a stronger aspect of your standing argument, but you tell me where this might be flawed, which is it's the affirmative defense makes certain actions lawful that would otherwise potentially be unlawful, and those actions would result in more pollution that affects your health and welfare.
Yeah, I think
that's true.
Without
getting into the procedural rights thing, it just struck me, it's not quite an exemption, but it's a possibility of an exemption that's going to, obviously you wouldn't have it unless it applied in certain cases, and that means more pollution, which affects your health and welfare.
Changes the substantive effect of the law.
Yeah.
It creates a shield for them, and they're going to take advantage of it whenever possible.
I mean, whether you run into steel, coal, and laid law later on is a different question. I mean, it's a cute argument, but I think that's down the line. You may or may not meet those requirements to hold standing in enforcement suits, but it looks like, as Judge Kavanaugh is saying, they're changing their reach with the substantive law by adding an affirmative defense.
Exactly. They've changed how we protect ourselves, and that harm has already happened. We're hurt now, and we have standing to challenge that change
unless the affirmative defense never works,
right?
Which would be
strange,
yes,
considering the industry supported it, and EPA thinks it's necessary, as they wouldn't have done a hopeless thing anyway. But I think if I can return to the merits,
sure,
at this the act is clear that EPA lacks power to tell district courts that penalties aren't an appropriate remedy in citizen suits. Section 304A of the Clean Air Act gives district courts jurisdiction.
Do you think a district court, this is a future case, do you think the district court could create the affirmative defense?
No. Under Section 113E1 of the Act, there are listed factors that the district court must consider in determining the amount of civil penalties to apply. If it said, well, you met this one factor, therefore we're not going to look at the other factors, that would be plainly unlawful.
Do you think that the district court, in considering the appropriate penalties, could fold in the same considerations that have gone into the thinking behind the affirmative defense?
Yes, I think this is, you know, these factors could be considered, but there are other factors that Congress directed them to be considered, and the problem here is that EPA is trying to tell district courts that it can't follow the law, that the district courts can't follow the law. And EPA simply has no power to do that. EPA is trying to use its 301A power, but that only gives it authorization to issue rules to carry out. It only gives the EPA administrator power to issue rules to carry out his functions, and 304A doesn't give EPA any functions. It only makes EPA the target of citizen suits.
But you don't dispute that in an individual case, a district court would have authority under the statute to decide not to impose civil money penalties where the circumstances are ones that are encompassed by the affirmative defense.
It might, but that's a decision for the district court to make. The question here is really who gets to make that decision, EPA or the district court, and the statute is, I think, crystal clear that EPA gets to make that decision. EPA doesn't have any power to tell district courts what their jurisdiction is. The City of Arlington case that recently came out puts this quite succinctly. It says, the judiciary, not any executive agency, determines the scope, including the available remedies of judicial power vested by statutes establishing private rights of action. That's this case. I think that decides it. If you don't have any more questions for me, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Oakes.
May it please the Court, Matt Oakes for the United States. With me at council table is Stephen Silverman from EPA's Office of General Counsel. This case revolves around the petitioner's repeated attempts to compel overcompliance with Portland Cement MAC standards. Is that better? Petitioners make arguments under 112D7, 112D2, 112I3A, and each of these arguments attempt to force EPA to revert back to the standards that were promulgated in 2010. In response to this court's remand, EPA reconsidered all of the standards that were initially promulgated in 2010 and set new standards. And one of the fundamental distinctions in this case is that the 2013 standards are new standards. They're based on a new record. They're based on new consideration of that record. Petitioner's arguments under D7 failed because their interpretation of D7 isn't compelled by the language of the statute. Their arguments under D2 fail because EPA was not forced to set beyond the floor standards for the particulate matter standard because EPA was permitted to consider cost efficiency of the standards. And this court has recently recognized that in the National Association of Clean Water Agencies case. And petitioner's arguments under 112I3A fail because EPA reconsidered the 2010 standards and based its compliance date on the new standards. And it assessed that compliance date to be as expeditious as practicable.
On your on the weakened standard issue, you talk about that first. You have two alternative arguments, as we discussed. And you changed the method of monitoring from continuous to stack. And the argument is, I believe, that, well, by doing that, at least some sources are going to be able to emit more of a pollutant at certain times. Maybe it won't be that way for other sources, but at least some sources will be able to emit more of a pollutant at a certain time, therefore it has weakened the standard.
So that conclusion is actually not consistent with the record and not what EPA found here. EPA found at Joint Appendix page 183, footnote 4, the 0.05 standard measured on a 30-day compliance average and the 0.07 standard measured as the result of stack testing were numerically equivalent. The change in stringency was based on the change of the standard from 0.04 pounds per ton clinker based on a 30-day average to 0.05 pounds per ton clinker.
Is it possible that a source could emit pollutants, the covered pollutants, in a way that would comply with the new standard but would not have complied with the old standard?
There's no record indication of that.
That wasn't my question, but is that possible?
Is it possible that a source could emit an amount that would violate the 0.07 standard but not violate the 0.05 standard measured as...
I think it was the other way around, yeah.
Okay.
The standards would not violate the 0.07 but would violate the 0.05.
Right. So the standards are different in form. The 0.05 standard is measured as a 30-day compliance average. So you take 30 days worth of data, right. You take the average of that, and that average basically wipes out a lot of the variability. When you take the 0.07 standard, measured as the result of a single stack test and three test runs from a single stack test, you're essentially taking a snapshot in time, which is why that standard is framed as a not-to-exceed standard. It's not an average of the same amount of data. So it's entirely possible.
It's possible to be weaker and possible to be stricter.
It could be weaker, it could be stricter, but it's statistically equivalent. And the way that the agency calculates statistical equivalency is using the student's t-test, which is a statistical test that's been around for 100 years.
Is it actually equally likely that it could be both stronger and weaker?
It is equally likely that it could be both stronger and weaker. In other words, the 0.05 standard measured as a 30-day average is statistically equivalent to the 0.07 standard measured as a not-to-exceed standard. That doesn't mean that you couldn't violate one or the other on a given day, but they're statistically equivalent. Basically, the number is higher when measured as a not-to-exceed standard, because you're taking a snapshot in time. You know less about the source emissions data. It would be like taking a particular baseball game and looking at a baseball player's average for that game. Maybe he hit three out of four at-bats, and his batting average would be 750. Well, it's unlikely that over a full season he would bat 750. But in any particular game, he might bat 750. He might hit 0 out of 4 and bat 0. You know, neither one of those is likely to be his average over the full season. Those are extremes, and accounting for that variability when you take the full average is essentially the equivalent of the difference between the 0.05 and the 0.07 standard. So EPA did two things here. The first thing that the agency did was it converted its 2010 standard based on the removal of the commercial incinerator data, and that's exactly what the court instructed the agency to do. That resulted in a less stringent standard, the conversion of a 0.04 to 0.05 standard, measured on the same scale. Now that difference, the 0.04 to 0.05, is what allowed sources different compliance options. And because the standard was less stringent and different compliance options were available. That is the basis for EPA's adjustment of the compliance date. The adjustment of that same standard from 0.05 to 0.07 was based on an entirely different reason. That didn't change the options available to the sources in terms of compliance options that were available. The reason that EPA felt compelled to change the standard from 0.05 to 0.07 was the 0.05 standard was based on the availability of continuous emissions monitoring systems. In other words, it was based on the source's ability to gather continuous data. The agency in 2010 thought the sources would be able to do that. Evidence was introduced in the 2013 rule that indicated that measured at the emissions control level, sources couldn't provide reliable information with continuous emissions sources data, with SEM systems. And the reason for that is that you couldn't calibrate the instruments. You didn't know if the numbers across different sources were measuring the same thing. They were emitting so
little. That's just why you switch.
Yeah, that's just why we switch. SEMS wasn't available.
Is did it weaken? We've discussed that. And right. if it did weaken, the question is, I guess your alternative argument, if I'm right on this, is that the statute doesn't prohibit such weakening in this circumstance.
Well, I mean, EPA certainly did promulgate a less stringent standard than it had promulgated in 2010, and that was a result of this court's remand.
Now, I'm talking about the switch from 05 to 07. If that were deemed to be weakening,
right, then EPA is permitted to.
Then you're still arguing in the alternative, as I understand it.
That's correct.
The statute permits that because of the word other doesn't encompass changes under 112D.
That's right. Because we read the word other in the context of the entire provision, of the entire D7 provision. And the D7 provision applies to standards promulgated under this section. With this section.
So just so I'm clear, those are independent arguments. We could do one. If you were correct, it could go on one or the other. We wouldn't have to reach both of those, correct? Namely,
that's correct, unless the court were to somehow take the position that EPA wasn't permitted to respond to this court's remand, and I find that unusual. Okay.
I don't know if there aren't questions. I have questions about the compliance date.
Okay.
I don't understand. I need help on the compliance date for the other pollutants. I don't understand the interrelatedness.
Okay. So the way that you control, and when you say the other pollutants, there's a suite of pollutants: particulate matter, hydrochloric acid,
other
mercury.
Other than PM.
Yeah, other than PM, but it's not for all of the emission standards set under the statute. There were also standards for open
plant.
Yeah,
the other ones in the
so,
states.
Specify other, there's certain
three. Yeah, you had an argument about one of them, those three, but anyway, you know what I'm talking
right.
about.
Right. There are certain other pollutants that are also controlled by particulate control technology. And those are the other pollutants we're talking about, such as mercury. And what EPA did here is when it...
Let me focus my question.
Sure.
Why couldn't EPA have said, you still must comply by the original compliance date for mercury, hydrochloric acid, and comply by the later compliance date for PM? So what's the problem with EPA saying that? That's what I don't quite understand what's holding me up on this issue.
Okay. So the agency viewed those the emissions limitations for all of those pollutants as a single standard. And it viewed them as a single standard because the control, this is a control-based statute. The compliance deadline is based on a date that is expeditious as practicable to control to the standard that the agency sets. And when you look at the control options available to sources when they're controlling for those particular pollutants, the control options are interrelated. Your primary control mechanism to control each of those pollutants is the control of particulates.
Well, your argument, I'm really not following this.
Okay.
Make sure I'm getting this. The provision that you're implicitly relying on is expeditiously as practical.
That's correct.
Where are the agency's findings that say, given what you're suggesting in very general terms about controls and whatever else you need to say, that this just couldn't be. I didn't see that.
Okay. The response to comment document at page 543 to 44 of the joint appendix talks about the interrelatedness of the controls for each of these substances.
You say it's not practical.
Well,
I don't have any doubt that there is some interrelationship between the various regulators. There's no question about that. We understand that. But so what?
Well,
it's a statutory standard, and where does the agency make the findings to show us, the court, the reviewing agency, that the reviewing court, that compliance couldn't be done practically?
That's what the court found. I mean, that's what the agency found on Joint Appendix pages 188 to 189. That it couldn't be done. That the date that it set was the most expeditious practical date, and the reason it found that is because the controls are interrelated, and it viewed the regulation of those four pollutants.
I'll go back and read it. Okay. I just want to tell you what's bothering me. I read the agency to say, and I think they were informed by the settlement they had already reached, which in my own view was motoring them to reach this date because they had agreed with industry they would. And so they did, and so they had to explain it somehow. The only explanation I get is, well, you know, this makes it a little easier for them now. You know, why make them mess with two different dates when we can make one date? That's not a finding of practicality as I understand. I'm looking for something that tells me it can't be done. It was already done. The standards were fixed. They were done, and the three-year date was about to run.
It can't be done. So there's, when you look at the 2010 standards, and the agency found that compliance could be done by the compliance date that was set in the 2010, which I think is what's kind of the source of your concern. Is that right?
Let me hear the rest of your answer first.
Okay.
I'm questioning you.
When you look at the compliance dates based on the 2010 standards, the agency did find that it was practicable for sources to comply by a date that's earlier than the date they set here. But those dates also assumed the interrelationship of controls of particulate and these other pollutants. Now, what happens when you change...
Did it say that?
The dates that were most as expeditious as practical for the 2010 standard also considered the compliance dates for control of the particulate matter standard.
You could say because there is a tie here now with the particulate matter, and so there's no issue.
Right. There is a tie with the particulate matter.
No, you didn't say that. Is that what the agency wrote?
What the agency wrote?
I'm missing all of this. All of this. It seems to me you're writing the agency's decision now in a way that I missed. It may be there, and I'll go back and look, but I don't remember.
What the agency wrote is that it assessed the compliance options available to the industry. And when it assessed the compliance options available to the industry, and there's extensive record review of this, and I can give you the record citations if that would be helpful. It found that the most expeditious practicable date was the date that it set here because of the interrelated nature of the controls. Now, the agency certainly found that the controls were interrelated, and it certainly assessed compliance options available to the industry. And that's the basis for its finding that the compliance date...
See, the fact that... I'll have to go back and look at what you're talking about. The fact that... controls can be interrelated does not mean that these three standards do not exist on their own.
Right.
Controls can be interrelated. So what? That's my point. What? There was nothing to suggest coming off the 210 that those standards couldn't stand alone, no matter what happened to the rest.
But the agency found that control as individual pollutants wasn't practicable here because the control standards were tied together.
Here's what, again, if you had to comply with just the mercury... hydrochloric acid standards for 2013, by 2013, and you didn't have to comply with the PM standard until 2015, right? What is the problem with that? Is it just it's an exorbitant cost, it's a waste of money, because you'd have to do one control system and then another?
Okay, so the problem with that
is... Which I think is what's probably going on.
Right. When the standards were remanded in the Portland Cement Association case, they were remanded on the basis that the agency was going to reconsider the data that it used to set the standards. And there was indication in the record at that point that reconsideration of that data would change some of the standards. And in particular, there was indication that it would change the particulate matter standard. And so sources at that point had decisions to make, is how are we going to proceed in terms of implementing our compliance options?
Right.
And so they started implementing their compliance options at that point, but they can only take it up to a certain point because they don't know what the final particulate matter standard is going to be.
But don't they know at that point that the mercury and hydrochloric acid standards are looming?
But the particulate matter standard drives how it is that they set up their controls.
Right, so it would be pointless is probably not the right word, expensive, to proceed knowing that the PM standard would change.
And then, importantly, 15 months before the final date, before the promulgation of the final rule in this case, EPA proposed to change the standards. And on proposal, it was clear that the agency was going to change the PM standard.
Right.
And it was clear that the agency thought that different compliance options were available.
So I think it makes just enormous sense to keep them all together as a policy matter on the compliance date. I'm just wondering, and I think petitioners are arguing that the statute doesn't really contemplate that here because it sets forth standards for the different pollutants. There was a 3-year compliance date for mercury and hydrochloric acid, end of case. You know, if it costs a lot, it costs a lot.
But where's your best citation for what you are now saying, but you do not recall the agency saying?
Joint Appendix 188 to 189. JA 188 to 189. And the supplement to that is response to comment 543 to 544.
So do you think it was our prior decision that created an expectation that all four would go together? I mean, I didn't really see that argument in your brief, but I thought, okay, well, maybe there was confusion out there because of what was going to happen in response.
So I think the impact of the prior decision is that in the prior decision, there was a compliance standard for open clinker piles, and the control technology for the presumed control technology for that standard would be to enclose the open clinker pile. And what the court did in response to that is say, we believe that standard is going to change, and it makes no sense for sources to undergo the expense of implementing the control check technology of enclosing all of these clinker piles when the standard is going to change. That's an unnecessary expense. And we extended that analysis here, is where the standard is going to change. And in this case, it was the PM standard that changed, but that impacted the control options for these other standards. It doesn't make sense to require the agency.
Impacted, just to be clear, and this is redundant, but by impacted, you mean made it not impossible, but much more expensive.
That's right. I don't think we can argue
that. What does that mean? Why? Is there a board, a control board, that is wired with PM included and PM not included, and the wiring will be incredibly more expensive? What are you talking about when you say it'll be more expensive?
Because
if the agency explains it, fine, I'll go look again. I missed this completely.
Okay. The best citation for this particular idea is probably JA-140, where it walks through the and a supplement to that is JA-190 to 191.
These agencies are very adept at writing to a statutory provision that says as practical. And I don't remember the agency writing to that standard here and explaining the change in deadlines. It's not practical. It's a very easy thing for agencies to do it all the time. We can't do it because the controls are all fit together, and if you change one, you're affecting everything, and here's how it works, and so we're not going to make them do it. Where is all of that? That's a very easy thing to write. EPA does this all the time.
Right, and that's actually how the process works.
I understand you may think that's how it works. What I want to know as a reviewing judge is where is it? Where's that language?
Right. And the actual impact on the control technology is summarized in a chart on JA190 to 191. That's in written form at JA187 to 188. And the raw data, the survey data that was submitted by industry that the EPA was reviewing. Those last two citations were to the wrong page. It's JA490 to 491 is the summary data chart. JA487 to 488 is that in written form. And JA408 to 440 is the raw data.
Affirmative defense?
Absolutely. As an initial matter, petitioners have not established their standing to challenge the affirmative defense.
I don't get that for the reason I explained before, which is they're saying there's a something that would have been unlawful now will be lawful in certain circumstances, therefore more pollutants, therefore it affects my health. Seems like a pretty straightforward case of...
Right. So actually the affirmative defense is just with respect to penalties. It's not with respect to injunctive relief at all. So if you're concerned about actually controlling emissions, controlling the stuff that gets pumped into the air, to the extent that a court can issue an order that stops that for an unforeseeable and unforeseen event, which is part of this. This affirmative defense only applies to malfunctions.
Was the affirmative defense in the recent Fifth Circuit case that you rely on the merits, Luminant? Was the affirmative defense there also limited to penalties?
Yes, the affirmative defense there was also limited.
So would there also have been a standing objection in that case? Why wouldn't it be the same standing argument? But yet, you were in that case. Did you make a standing objection in that case?
We did not make a standing objection in that
case. And is there a reason that you would not have made one there, but you would make one here?
Well,
what Judge Gavanaugh has been saying, there isn't a standing objection.
There is a standing objection here.
The court then had to expose it. It's Article 3 if there's a standing objection. The court can't ignore it. They had to raise it sua sponte. A lot of people missed it.
The court's not infallible, and we realized there was a standing objection here, and we raised it. And the reason that the continuing emissions or the potential future emissions aren't impacted, in other words, the reason there's no deterrence value here is because they can get injunctive.
You would agree that there would be standing to challenge an exemption that matched the affirmative defense?
An exemption wouldn't be permissible.
Standing. If there were an exemption, say it was permissible, an exemption from the statute for this kind of situation that's covered by the affirmative defense, would someone in petitioner's shoes have standing to challenge that exemption?
So it's assuming it was permissible, assuming the Sierra Club 2008 case doesn't exist, and that 302K doesn't exist, which is a lot of assumptions,
was there standing in Sierra Club 2008? Yes. Right? Because they're standing to challenge the exemption because it weakens the standard in some circumstances, allows more pollutants, affects my health. Well, now this is kind of a junior varsity exemption with a affirmative defense. I don't see how the standing analysis really changes unless the affirmative defense is a null set.
Well, the affirmative defense, to begin with, is distinct from the standard. The standard hasn't been challenged.
I understand that.
And in terms of standing with respect to that, it's petitioner's obligation to establish they've been injured by that affirmative defense, and none of their arguments demonstrate that injury. Affirmative defenses have been recognized by EPA since 1999 in the SIP context. They've been around for well more than a decade. There's no evidence in the form of declarations that goes to show...
That goes to the merits. That's not...
Maybe we should talk about them, fold in the merits of the affirmative defense while we're at it.
But first, with respect to the standing points, our standing argument goes to their lack of a demonstration of a cognizable injury here. And what I'm saying with respect to the fact that affirmative defenses have been around since 1999 is that there's no reason that they shouldn't have been able to gather evidence to show a cognizable injury here. And all of their evidence regarding injury is speculative. It's that these may increase costs. Well, they haven't demonstrated they've increased costs because they would still have to establish the penalty factors, even if the affirmative. So
the court in Laidlaw said, we understand that civil penalties have an important deterrent effect. If you're in the protected category, you have standing to sue the claim for civil penalties, unless you're in a Steel Co. situation where you file too late. So it's no news that civil penalties are a remedy for the kind of injuries that they're talking about. They are in the protected class. They have shown that they're in the protected class of individuals. And they can seek the civil penalties unless they miss the deadlines, as in Steel Co. I don't understand the standing. You may have an argument on the merits, but I just don't, as Judge Kavanaugh said, I don't see the standing at all.
All right, well, shall we turn to the merits?
I didn't say at all, but but it was close. Why don't you go to the merits of it? Yeah.
Okay, so with respect to the merits, EPA has authority to promulgate an affirmative defense under Section 301A1 of the statute, which enables the agency to balance the tension that's created in the statute between the continuous emissions requirements, 302K, and the case law such as Bunker Hill and Essex Chemical and Weyerhaeuser and Marathon Oil that consistently recognizes that EPA has the flexibility to recognize the fact that some emissions due to unavoidable malfunctions will occur. And because EPA has the flexibility to recognize that, and in some...
Why isn't that to cut to the chase of what petitioner's saying, why isn't that the court's role in a given private citizen suit, and EPA can, of course, come in as amicus or intervener in such a case and say, here, court, you should recognize an affirmative defense for the following reasons under the statute, and the court can consider that. I don't see how EPA can create this affirmative defense and have it apply in that private civil suit. That's my concern.
So a function of the administrator is to determine the regulatory framework that surrounds the standard. And when determining the regulatory framework that surrounds the standard, the agency promulgates numerous provisions that are more than just a strict numeric emissions limitation. It promulgates record-keeping requirements, inspection requirements, monitoring requirements. It clarifies which aspects of a plant the standards apply to. It defines when exceedances of parametric monitoring constitutes a violation.
I guess the problem is it just seems like with this particular one, you may have some authority around the edges of the standard, as you rightly point out, but with this particular one, it seems like the statute gives this to the office of the courts to determine when is a civil money penalty appropriate. That statutory provision is talking about the court that's hearing the action. It's not talking about EPA determining that. So it seems like you have an Adams Fruit issue, because it's not a question as to which you get deference, because this authority wasn't delegated to the agency to begin with. You do have a lot of authority under the statute. This particular one, though, seems like it resides within the office of the court.
So there's a distinction between this and the scenario faced in Adams Fruit. In Adams Fruit, that dealt with the Agricultural Workers Protection Act, and the statute itself both created a cause of action and defined what it meant to define the standards, essentially, that employers had to comply with. And if a migrant worker took the position that his employers were doing something that was inconsistent with the statute, it could bring the claim under the statute and demonstrate a violation with the terms of the statute. That's not the way this statute works. This statute grants EPA the authority to define its regulations. It defines the emission standard under 112D, and it defines the associated regulatory framework.
But the agency in Adams Fruit had authority over the standard, too. I thought the whole argument of the court was whether it went to the standard. And what the court said was, we have authority over the standard, but this has to do with whether a cause of action is available. And that's something that's within the office of the courts. And it seems like that analytical framework would equally apply here. I'm not following why that doesn't apply here.
Well, I think the distinction is that here the agency is defining essentially what the violation is, whereas in the Adams Fruit context, the terms of what the violation were defined. And so because EPA has regulatory authority in this case, it can exercise that regulatory authority to define a violation in a way that includes an affirmative defense.
Well, first of all, I don't see how you're defining what an evaluation is if, as you rightly say, injunctive relief is still available. So I think there's been a violation. What you're talking about is the circumstances in which civil penalties are going to be available.
Right, and we've used the ancillary rulemaking authority to say that civil penalties are off the table. Now, if a court found that civil penalties were available, then the court absolutely has discretion under 113E1 to determine the amount of that penalty.
And to determine whether they're available at all in that case.
And here, the agency has used its rulemaking authority to say that for some aspects of a violation, penalties are not available.
It absolutely has sought to do that, and the question is whether it has validly done that, I guess.
And the agency takes a position that that's a valid exercise of its ancillary rulemaking authority under 301A1.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Carter Phillips for the Portland Cement Industry, and may it please the Court. Judge Edwards, I think I want to start with the question you posed, which is where is it that the EPA has tied the various techniques of pollution control up in a way that demonstrates that it's not...
Because I've been looking for
it. It's page 540 of the Joint Appendix where it talks about the engineering judgments and the fact that under the standard as it existed before this court intervened in the Portland cement case, there was only one method of solving the problem of particulate matters, and that was using this baghouse in a variety of ways. When you move to a 0.5 standard, you immediately open up a variety of other alternatives. The problem was that is that as you implement controls on the other pollutants, it affects exactly how you're going to implement with respect to the particulate matters. And what I think EPA did was it made a reasonable judgment, and it did it on the basis of an enormous amount of information that my clients put forward to show these are all of our plants. We have all of these kilns. Almost 90% of all the kilns in the country are analyzed to say what is it that we can do that will bring us into compliance with the new 0.5 standard and allow us to do it with a monitoring system that is going to be substantially more reliable, as EPA had said. And therefore, at the end of the day, you will end up with a much better pollution control system overall. And
this, at 188, they say the mercury, THC, and HCI standards all typically involve some element of PM generation and capture. And so the controls must be integrated with PM control strategies.
Yes, that is precisely the point you're going to make. Because otherwise, if you don't...
That's what you feel they are resting on.
Well, I think they do a better job of explaining it at 540, but it's simply...
There are other places as well, but right. I'm just trying to find something that seems straight to the point. That's your argument.
Yes, I think it is quite straight and to the point, because what it's saying is that it makes no sense, having gone to court to get the standards modified the way we did, have the court agree that it was arbitrary and capricious to apply a 0.4 standard, change it to 0.5, recognizing that changes dramatically the landscape, but that you cannot implement any of these on a one-off basis. You really have to do it in an integrated fashion. To be sure, it will save money. It will also be a significantly more reliable system than the system we have otherwise.
I think I agree with you that it makes complete sense to have these things travel together, so to speak, but can you kind of link that back up to the statute in a way that makes sense right there? Because the statute doesn't always make sense, as we know.
Right. Expeditiously as practicable is hardly a command as to how to deal with a particular problem. It seems to me when EPA has made a specific finding that's not challenged, that it would be essentially irrational, either as an economics matter, but probably even as an engineering matter, to go after these pollutants one at a time. That you really, it's only rational to go at them simultaneously and to do it in an integrated fashion, then it seems to me that what is practicable under those circumstances has to take into account more than the single pollutant one at a time. And certainly nothing in the statute that says that EPA, or doesn't say categorically, that EPA does not have that kind of authority.
So I think their response to that is, but it's 3 years is the outside date for the compliance period, and for those other standards, namely the mercury and hydrochloric acid, the 3 years runs from 2010. And so,
that's a hyper-literal, potentially, reading,
but that's their point.
And but EPA said it was that there is no 2010 rule now. The 2013 rule supersedes the 2010 rule.
Is that because the term statutory term standard overarches all of the pollutants, or is there a separate standard?
Perfectly reasonable way to interpret it, I think. And EPA ought to be entitled to analyze it that way.
And did they, in fact, interpret that in the materials that gave rise to this rule? Or was that the rationale that was set forth in the Federal Register, that there's the standard that's referred to in the three-year statute is actually an overarching one that encompasses all the pollutants? Or was the agency still operating on the assumption that there's a separate standard for each pollutant?
Well, I mean, they recognize that there is a separate standard for each pollutant. On the other hand, they have to apply it to individual industries as they go forward and come up with a mechanism for doing it. So, and as applied to this particular industry, clearly, the only way to think about this is an integrated, looking at our prior decision,
we didn't say this, but it seems unlikely that the court would have said, oh, go redo the PM, but by the way, the other ones still have the same effective date if it makes no sense to have different effective dates. And obviously we didn't cross that bridge in the prior decision, but I wonder if that's implicit in the prior decision.
Well, I mean, obviously when they were dealing with the clinker piles, the panel in the prior decision expressly recognized that there was going to be a change. I think actually it's quite possible that the panel thought that by solving the Kiswick conundrum, as the oral argument discussed the last time around, it might not ultimately make any actual change. But as it turned out, it did. And I'm quite certain that this court, if it had known or had been told, yeah, it looks like it's going to make a significant change, would have said, that's fine. Then there's no, let's wait. Nobody should be spending the amount of money and energy and time to solve one problem that's got to be integrated with other problems. So to be sure, none of this came up during that oral argument. But all this ultimately turns out to be, I think, is an effort by the other side to essentially backdoor to force us back into the 0.4 standard that the court said, no, that's arbitrary and capricious.
Just so I understand that, and that's because to comply by 2013, or really by now, or last week, whenever it was,
months ago,
with the mercury and hydrochloric acid standards would effectively require you to put in technology that would back you up to
that would put you to the 0.4 standard, in which case you lose all of the options that would otherwise be available and that should have been available to us from the beginning if the EPA had not engaged in arbitrary and capricious decision-making in the first instance. With respect to the difference between 0.05 and 0.07 and whether how those things do in fact translate arithmetically, it's a complicated formula to be sure, but we did argue quite categorically the last time around that the arithmetic worked to our disfavor, and the court rejected that.
Right.
It said all of so it seems to me the court's already been down this road. I mean, I don't want to get whipsawed here where I lose it coming up and lose it coming back. I mean, it seems to me the court really ought to deal with this as straightforward. 0.07 is not the change. That's just a method of compliance, a method of monitoring compliance, and that it works without any substantial difference.
And you also agree with EPA that if we resolve that issue on the statutory language ground, we don't even need to address that, right?
Right. And I thought counsel's concession on that to Judge Srinivasan is pretty devastating, frankly, where he says his use of other has to be the only way to read this statute. Whatever else you want to say about the language of the statute, there is more than one way to read it. And candidly, I think the more plausible one is to follow what the heading of the provision says, which is other requirements, not the requirements that are embodied in 112B7. So we have the statutory argument, but I think frankly you don't actually need to get there. I suppose I should spend a little bit of time on the affirmative defense. I guess the place where it strikes me that the difference here is this doesn't make legal what would have been illegal. All right, we know that.
Right.
And so that basis doesn't get you there. And then when you apply the Steele case, given the standards for the affirmative defense, which means that it has to have been abated, it has to be over with. Otherwise, it's not available. So for them to show up, at that point, it's not available. I mean, you can't get a civil penalty under those circumstances for that kind of conduct.
Can I just go back? Even though
they don't have standing to get a civil penalty.
It doesn't
penalty.
Make legal what otherwise would be illegal, but it makes likely legal in certain circumstances what otherwise would be illegal.
Well, I don't think it ever makes it.
It's got to make a difference, or else you wouldn't.
No, I'm not saying it doesn't make a difference. I'm just saying I don't think it makes it legal. I think it just takes off a single remedy.
Well, it'll result in your clients prevailing in certain cases where they otherwise wouldn't prevail.
Not having to pay money in circumstances where they might not otherwise. But I don't know that necessarily. I mean, I don't see how that. Unless you can demonstrate that there's some, you know, that's not money that goes to them. That's money that goes to the federal government.
That didn't matter in Laid Law.
It mattered in steel company.
Laid Law is the later, larger statement, as you well know. Laid Law, Justice Ginsburg made it very clear that the civil penalty has a deterrent effect, and you can base your standing on that, even if the money's not coming to you.
But as it arises in this context, the idea...
So you're trying to... I have to jump in.
No, that's your prerogative.
You say that now, what are you going to say when you leave?
Well, I best I don't offer up anything on that.
So you're really trying to piggyback on the likelihood that they will not have standing later on into a claim that they have no standing now, and that just doesn't follow. I can understand your claim that given Steel Co. and Laid Law, most of these cases later on, they might not be in play for want of standing. But that doesn't tell us anything about whether they have a right to be or not. Challenging this.
It does as a redress. It does seem to me as a redressability matter, because what you're talking about is such an attenuated sequence of events that the idea that they're here to get this relief will, in fact, give them anything is so inherently speculative that the court ought to toss it on that alternative ground. That to me at least is the stronger one. I mean I'm not bowled over by their injury argument. I suspect that doesn't surprise you, but it seems to me from my perspective, the easier way for you to say they have no standing, frankly, is to simply say this there's no redressability under these circumstances. It's too far out. It's too difficult as that follows. I see my time is up if the court has other questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'll give you several minutes for rebuttal, as long as it takes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I'd like to just start really quickly with the idea that we're trying to sort of use a backdoor attempt to resuscitate an old standard. Just to be very clear, our clients are here because they've been deprived of protection from hazardous air pollutants that Congress intended to be in place 16 years ago. They've never had that. That's what they're trying to do here. As to the, there are some statements.
So, yeah, but on the three-year thing, which is what you're getting at there, for the other pollutants, which is what's been subject of discussion, their response to your argument is the statute says standard. There's a standard for mercury and hydrochloric acid, 3 years, boom, done. Their argument is that can't possibly be right in the circumstances of this case where they're interrelated for cement kilns, where the prior decision essentially said redo the particulate matter standard or re-examine that, and the prior decision couldn't have contemplated, I think is what I'm now thinking, the prior decision couldn't have contemplated, EPA might redo particulate matter, but not redo mercury and hydrochloric acid and leave this chaos, and I'm probably overstating it, but that's how they would probably term it, chaos in how they're supposed to comply with what's going on here.
Well, maybe I guess a good starting point then would be the previous decision, the PCA decision, and then I can move on to the statute. Yeah. The PCA court declined to vacate the old standard. It remanded without vacature, and it remanded without a stay. The court knew perfectly well.
Sorry to interrupt, and I'll let you finish. I'm sorry. But in contemplation that it might be changed.
Right. It knew that it might be changed, but it chose to leave the compliance clock ticking. That was the plain import of the decision to vacate to remand without a vacature. If it had vacated, there would be no compliance clock. If it had granted the stay that they asked for, the compliance clock wouldn't have run.
Here's what I guess is troubling me. If you look at the prior decision, what do you think the court would have thought about what happens if EPA changes particulate matter with a, therefore, new compliance date triggered, whether the court would have contemplated changing also the compliance date for the other, or would have said, no, you got to stick with the others, even though, according to EPA, that leads to a nonsensical result?
I think the court didn't expect the compliance date to change for any of these pollutants, and it's not just because the court declined to vacate or stay the standards. EPA represented to them, and the court accepted, that the change from 0.04 to 0.05 would leave kilns' compliance strategies unaltered. And contrary to what EPA's lawyers and the interveners are trying to tell you, that statement has never been changed in the record. There's no statement anywhere in the record that the 0.04 to 0.05 change would have any effect on kilns' compliance strategies. That's what EPA represented to this court in papers that it filed with this court in the PCA case, and the PCA court noted that representation in its decision not to stay the compliance date. So what the court anticipated is that the compliance date for all of these standards would move ahead. There's nothing in that case that
there's silence on that, right?
Well, I think it's more than silence. I mean, I think the decision not to vacate or stay.
Well, the court didn't say the compliance date shall stay the same.
Well, I mean, it stayed the standard for clinker piles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the difference in treatment for something that it, you know, intended to stop the compliance on and something that it did not intend to stop the compliance clock on is pretty eloquent.
But it seems like what probably happened is that at that point in time, neither the court nor maybe anybody else was anticipating that there would be a change from continuous to stack.
Well, let me address that too, because that change the court didn't anticipate that change, that's correct. That change is entirely voluntary, and the question is, does that change, we're now sort of past what the PCA court meant, does that change allow the EPA to extend the compliance date, either, past the as expeditious as practical language or past the three-year language? And I think the answer to that is no. First of all, EPA didn't have authority to make that change at all.
It's beyond the scope of the remand?
It was beyond the scope. It wasn't part of the remand, and it violates the statute. But even looking past that, the fact that EPA made that change doesn't make it any less practicable.
Wait, why is it? Never mind. Okay, keep going.
The fact that EPA made that change doesn't make it any less practicable for sources to comply. Contrary to their statements, there's nothing in EPA statements that it's not practicable for sources to comply with any of these standards, either the mercury, HCl, or THC standard, or even the particulate matter standard by 2013. What EPA is offering is a completely different argument, this policy argument that sources ought to be allowed another 2 years to deploy compliance alternatives.
You want the compliance date for all to be 2013. They want the compliance date for all to be 2015. Your backup argument is, okay, even if compliance date is 2015 for PM, keep 2013 for the others. But I think your backup argument, you would agree, I think we discussed earlier, and everyone would agree, it really doesn't make sense in the real world to have these different dates. And you would, your first argument is you're right, they should all be 2013, right?
Well, as to the backup argument, I think it really does make sense. To the extent there is some sort of balancing, that it's a question of, is it expensive for industry? Does it make sense on that level? I think the balance should tilt strong.
Do you agree? It's just dumb to have different compliance dates for these different forms of pollutants for cement kilns. Colloquial, but I think accurate here.
I don't know whether it's ideal or not, but I do know this. People have been waiting for 16 years to get relief from the mercury pollution and the organic toxic organic pollutants and the hydrogen chloride. And to the extent that there's some kind of balancing going on, the balancing should favor those people who have been deprived of protection that they're entitled to.
And in this context, right. I mean, I guess you don't necessarily have to go, or the EPA doesn't necessarily have to go all the way to dumb, right? Because they do say in the regulatory materials that these things are interrelated, and that Joint Appendix 188 that THC and HCL standards all typically involve some element of PM generation and capture, and so the controls must be integrated with the PM control strategy. So wouldn't you have to show that there's actually something deeply flawed about
EPA? No, what I want to make clear is that we're simply talking about this as a policy matter. If you go back to the statute, those arguments don't go either to the three-year standard or to practicability. Those standards go to convenience and expense. It may be true that sources could comply more cheaply if they did everything together. But that's not what the statute is concerned about. The statute couldn't be clearer that Congress's concern was expedition.
Well, that's what I think you make a reasonable point there. And so I think you agree, although you don't have to say you agree, but I think you probably agree that it would make most sense to have all the pollutants compliant states be the same. And then you would say, in response to the interrelated, well, that's true as a policy matter, but the statute here is what the statute says for the other pollutants, mercury and hydrochloric acid, and you EPA are stuck with that regardless of the consequences.
I think at least that's
the last part of that you agree with, right? The last part of that is I don't think the prior court could have contemplated if PM were changed that, oh, but the others would stay the same, would stay with the same compliance state and create this odd system. Maybe not. I guess we don't know. Go ahead.
I think that the prior court made it itself clear that it wanted things to move ahead on those standards, unlike the clinker storage pile. And apart from what the court found, the statute is clear. But to move on to the weakening of the standards. Very quickly, the notion that these standards didn't weaken is at odds with the record because EPA itself said that the 0.07 standard would allow sources to cancel compliance upgrades. There's no such statement with respect to the change from 0.04 to 0.05, and in fact, all EPA has ever said with respect to that change is that it left compliance strategies unaltered. There's simply no way to get around that record conflict with what EPA's lawyers are saying. The other point they're trying, and that's dispositive, but there's another point they're trying to make, which is that somehow the numerical increase from 0.05 to 0.07 is canceled out by taking away the 30-day averaging period. The truth is EPA didn't take away the 30-day averaging period. It's still in the regulatory text at page 215 of the joint appendix. The only difference is that now plants get to comply over 30 days with a continuous parameter monitoring system instead of a continuous emissions monitoring system. What they get to do is to measure their compliance with the 0.07 standard over 30 days, whereas before they were measuring their compliance with the 0.05 standard over 30 days. And finally, there's even more wrong with that notion that EPA didn't weaken the standard, which is that somehow eliminating a requirement that sources comply all year long under all conditions and instead let them require once a year under a stack test where they choose the time, choose the conditions, and control the conditions carefully is simply not tenable. In fact, EPA recognized that itself in one of the previous Federal Register notices at page 2 of the joint appendix, where it said these stack tests don't reflect the full range of variability, therefore, because they're under controlled conditions. And PCA recognized that point, too. The other thing PCA has recognized, by the way, is that it is the 0.06, it is the 0.07 standard that opens up new compliance options. That's at page 328 and 371 of the joint appendix. EPA requested a standard between 0.06 and 0.08 because that standard would open up new compliance options for them. EPA, they didn't say that 0.05 would suffice. It had to be greater than 0.06. And by the way, it wasn't that EPA changed the compliance state either. On page 328 to 329, they say the compliance regime, changing the compliance regime doesn't change anything. In fact, they call it quite similar, the two compliance regimes. It's the change of the number that matters. The notion that all pollutants are one pollutant, jumping back to the compliance state extension, that's inconsistent with EPA's own description of all of these emission standards as separate emission standards in the record for this rule. It's inconsistent with this court's repeated decisions that EPA sets different emission standards for different pollutants, for example, in the National Lime case. It's simply not tenable, and EPA didn't raise this argument in the record below. So even if there was some ambiguity in the statute, which there isn't, they wouldn't be entitled to deference on that issue. The other point I'd like to touch on really quickly is Section 112D2, which is the other weakening argument. And counsel for EPA suggested that, or didn't suggest it, but stated that this court's decision in the sewage sludge incinerator case, the NACWA case, sewage sludge incinerator case, resolves that issue. That, first of all, I would say there's a pending rehearing petition, a rehearing on bank petition on that case, on that particular issue. But beyond that, the court did not hold that any level, it didn't absolve EPA from determining the maximum achievable degree of reduction, and it didn't hold that any level of emission reduction at all that EPA determines to be cost effective is per se the maximum degree of reduction that can be achieved. That's what EPA is arguing here. The only reason that EPA is saying that the standard it promulgated back in 2010, the 0.04 standard, is a promulgated standard, a standard that EPA itself called achievable in the record for this rulemaking, the only reason that EPA is saying that that's not achievable within the meaning of the statute is that it doesn't think it's cost effective. To be sure, the NACWA decision found that EPA permissibly considered cost effectiveness or cost per pound in determining the maximum achievable degree of reduction. That's different than declaring that for all future rules, the level that EPA thinks is cost effective is the maximum achievable degree of reduction. And in fact, that would be at odds with the statute, which clearly requires the maximum, not just what EPA thinks is reasonable, and with the Donovan line of cases, which makes clear that there's a big difference between what EPA thinks is cost effective and what's achievable considering cost. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. I'll talk quickly about standing again. Laidlaw said we had standing to seek civil penalties. Congress said they had a deterrent effect, and the courts defer to that judgment because EPA is saying that penalties aren't available in circumstances in which they otherwise would be available. It's reducing their deterrent effect. We're injured by that. Also, for that reason, the fact that injunctive relief remains available doesn't defeat our standing. That's like saying you need food and water to survive, but so long as you have water, you're going to live. Steel Code doesn't apply here. The change has already happened. EPA has already taken away, already changed the law. And also, as we explained in detail in our standing declarations, plants are going to invoke this defense even when it might not hold up in court. Jim Hecker's standing declaration describes a citizen suit that he actually prosecuted where plants invoked a similar defense, saying that, well, our 15,000 hours of violations, a lot of those were not reasonably preventable. They couldn't have been, they were unavoidable, they were infrequent. And as a result of running into that defense, it drove up the costs of the case, and it ended up settling before going through with trial. That's a harm to us also. Jennifer Swearingen also described, you know, that the Holcim plant near her routinely claims the malfunction exemption for the upsets that happen every single year. Plants know that claiming the affirmative defense is going to limit their liability. They're going to claim it, and we're going to be hurt by that as it reduces the deterrent effect of civil penalties. Moving to the merits, EPA claims it's balancing a tension here, but there's no tension within the act that it's balancing. It's just a policy argument. EPA doesn't think it's fair for plants to have to pay penalties in circumstances where Congress said courts should determine what penalties are available. That's not EPA's place to make that decision. That's not a tension that EPA can reasonably balance. EPA relies on no binding cases in this circuit at all for trying in when it tries to manufacture this tension. As you pointed out, Adams Fruit is indistinguishable from this case, I think. In both, Congress vested power in the courts to determine the remedies, including civil penalties. If I could just...
Sure.
Thank
one
you.
One more point.
EPA is relying on its Section 301A authority, but it's very well established in this court that Section 301A can't override more specific provisions of the Act. EPA is a creature of statute. It only has the powers that Congress gave it. Congress didn't give it any power to override the judiciary in a citizen suit action. The affirmative defense should be vacated.
Thank you. Well argued all around. The case is submitted. Mm-hmm.